following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
Well, congratulations. If nothing else, you started the new year on the right foot. Now, don't get me wrong. It's not that you deserve some brownie points for coming to church on a holiday. It's not what I'm saying. Rather, by choosing to be here today, you've made a decision that your relationship with God is a priority. It's something that's worth investing in. And your decision, hopefully, is setting a direction that you'll pursue throughout 2023. The first day of the new year is a great opportunity to stop, to take our bearings, and to make corrections on the course that we're following. That's why so many people start the year with a list of resolutions or goals. It's just a natural time to do that. And we all need those times of realignment, because let's face it, we have a tendency to drift, don't we? And that's okay, because sometimes we're just so busy trying to navigate whatever life throws at us that we begin to get knocked off course a little bit. It's hard to stay the course when you're always getting pushed around. And that's especially true after what so many of us have endured the last coming up on 3 years. Can you believe it? How many times since March 2020 have you felt like you were just trying to put one foot in front of the other to keep climbing up the hill and keep from sinking in the mud? Anybody besides me ever feel that way? Yeah. Yeah. So it's normal when you're doing that to drift a little bit, to get off the path a little bit. And right now is an excellent opportunity to take a pause. You know, we just come to the holiday season. Everything's disrupted anyway. Kind of slows down a little bit. So we stop right now. We take a little pause. We take the lay of the land. And we make sure we're headed in the right direction, both as individuals and as a church. Now, for the next 5 weeks, we're going to be taking stock. We're going to be getting back to basics. We're going to be refocusing. And we're going to focus on 5 key attitudes that we need to cultivate, not only in our personal lives, but also in the culture of our church. That's why we handed out those bookmarks. That's why we're asking you to pray about those values. And each week, we're going to focus on different aspects, different priorities. And we're going to try to, hopefully, as we do that, we're going to stick through this journey. And what we do today is going to help shape the next month. It all begins, foundationally, putting ourselves completely at God's disposal. Because after all, that is the essence of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. Amen? As Kyle Idleman pointed out a few years ago in a best-selling book, Jesus has a number of fans in the world. But Jesus didn't come into the world to collect fans. He came into the world to call followers. Jesus doesn't want to be your hobby. Too many people treat Jesus like a hobby. Jesus came to be your life, to be your guiding star, to be the thing that you take your direction, your identity, and your security from. Listen to how the Apostle Paul describes this expectation. Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And I encourage you to have a Bible open here as we walk our way through these verses. Paul says this: "Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect." Does that sound like a casual relationship? Does that sound like something you can dip in and dip out of as the mood strikes you? Or does it sound like a real life-altering commitment? Now let's go back and break that down and walk our way through this to see exactly what Paul is saying to us today. And there's 5 things I want you to notice out of these 2 verses. One is this: everything that God has done for us calls for a response from us. You get that? Everything that God has done for us calls for a response to God from us. The word here, the very first word, therefore, prompts us to consider everything else that Paul has said in this letter of Romans up to this point. 11 chapters worth, okay? As I've told you before, and if some of you may hear this for the first time, this is a good rule of biblical interpretation to follow. Whenever you're reading the Bible and you come across the word therefore, you need to stop and ask, what is the therefore there for? Okay, and in this case, therefore refers back to everything else Paul's written in chapters 1 through 11 up to this point. Now, for those of you who have not spent much time in the book of Romans, basically Paul opens this letter by declaring his thesis that the gospel is, in his words, the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and to the Greek. That's in Romans 1, verse 16. And basically what Paul is saying there is this, the message of Jesus Christ, the message of Jesus and about Jesus is the power of God to save you and to change your life. And that goes whether you're a religious person, a Jew, or a non-religious person, a Greek. It's the same for everybody. The gospel is God's powerful means for transforming your life. And we need this salvation because the gospel reveals to us, as Paul says in Romans 1:18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. So there's an accountability, there's a judgment that is taking place over everything that is contrary to God. And as Paul says in Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fallen short of God's glory. That means every one of us. Religious person, non-religious person, good, the bad, the ugly. We all miss it. Don't go patting yourself on the back saying, I came to church on New Year's Day. That's good that you did. But the reality is, that doesn't make up for all the ways that we fall short of God's character in our daily lives. When we act unlovingly and selfishly and without giving God the glory that he is due, there is a collision that is about to happen because of that. And this gospel also warns us in Romans 3:20 that there's nothing we can do on our own to escape this holy judgment, because Paul says, by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight. That means you can be as good as you want to be. You can keep the Ten Commandments as good as you can keep the Ten Commandments. But that's not going to help you. All that's going to do is show you how far short you fall. Because you can never keep them perfectly. However, the point of the gospel is not negative. The point of the gospel, that's what gospel actually means, good news. We say, well, what's good about judgment? What's good about sin? What's good about all that? Well, here's the good news. God demonstrated his own love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And much more than having been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through him. Paul says that in Romans 5, verses 8 and 9. So God has provided everything we need to receive salvation. He's done it through his son Jesus Christ, who gave himself on the cross for our sakes. And we receive the benefit of Jesus' sacrifice by publicly and openly putting our full faith in him as our only Savior and submitting to him as our only Lord. Or as Paul puts it in Romans 10, verses 9 and 10, if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart a person believes, resulting in righteousness, and with the mouth he confesses, resulting in salvation. Just a couple of verses later, Paul quotes the Old Testament and says, whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. It's our faith in Jesus as our only hope, our only salvation that allows us to escape this judgment. So on the basis of everything God has done to make salvation possible for us, Paul urges us to offer a response back to God. Everything that God has done for us calls for a response from us. And this look back to chapters 1 through 11 is reinforced by Paul's exhortation to his readers. He says, therefore, I urge you, brethren. And he includes a sister in there as well. That includes everybody who considers himself a disciple of Jesus. But he says, I urge you. It's the Greek word parakaleo. And it, this is why this is important. In a lot of his letters, Paul typically uses this construction. I urge you to mark a shift from explanation to application. In other words, he goes from teaching doctrine to teaching ethics. From teaching right belief, now we're going to talk about how to encourage right behavior. In light of the truth that I'm teaching you, this is how you need to adjust your life. So when we see that in Romans 12:1, the light ought to go off. Oh, Paul's getting ready to tell us an expectation here, a response that we need to make. And Paul words this in such a way, it's grammatically, it's just short of a command. He's not necessarily commanding us to do this, because this is not something anybody can force on you. This is something you got to freely choose yourself. But it's stronger than a mere suggestion. Okay. Years ago, when I was in college, I had a class, Survey of English Literature, up to 1800. And the last thing we studied in that class was John Milton's Paradise Lost. I don't know how many of you have ever read John Milton's Paradise Lost, but it's pretty deep. But we had a really eccentric professor. We're coming on the end of the term, and he says, I'm going to give you a choice. It's the last day of class. He says, I'm going to give you a choice. I'm going to allow you to vote for what form your final exam is going to take. I have to go to a conference right after the final exam day, and I'm not going to have a lot of time to grade. So I'm going to give you the choice. I'm going to give you the choice of a short answer, or excuse me, 10 short answer questions, or you can have a standard essay type blue book test. For those of you who remember those days, basically you always, when you had that choice, you always wanted to choose the essay test normally, because at least you could get credit for what you knew, right? If they give you 10 short answers, they could ask something you don't know or you haven't studied and you're stuck. You know, what if he asked the wrong 10 questions? So usually you ask the essay question. Some of you remember that. I see some heads go, yeah, yeah. You ask the essay question because you can just download everything you know, and hopefully somewhere in the ballpark, you're going to get the right answer. But he said, I'm going to give you a choice on this. I urge you to choose the short answer test. He didn't command us, but he strongly urged us. Exam day came, and I'm so glad we voted to take that short answer test, because he was in such a hurry to get out of town. It was 10 questions based, the premise was, the first question I asked him was, what is your name? I'd always heard that joke. You know, we had 10 points on that test. What is your name? The other 9 questions were all, basically the premise was, you have just been named executive producer of a film adaptation of Paradise Lost. Question number 2, who would you cast in the main roles? The whole test was like that. So he didn't command us, but he urged us. It was in our best interest to choose that test. Paul is not commanding us to the way that we respond, but he is strongly urging us. It is in our best interest to do this. And this response to the gospel is also insinuated by the phrase, when he says, by the mercies of God. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God. In Greek, the preposition that Paul uses here is the preposition dia. And it can be translated either as by, in other words, on the basis of, or it can be translated as through, by means of. And the context here actually does not rule out either one of those interpretations. It may actually include both of them. See, God did not have to offer us rescue from his righteous wrath. He could have just scoured the world clean and started from scratch. But in mercy, he chose to offer us a way out. He chose to when he didn't have to. That's mercy. God loved you so much that he came up with a way to satisfy the demands of justice and to bring you restoration. And the expression of mercy deserves a response. By the mercies of God. Now it begs the question, what form should this response take? And so Paul goes on to tell us that. According to Paul, our only logical response to what God has done for us is to offer our whole selves back to him. That's the only thing that makes sense. God says that on the basis of God's mercy, we should present our bodies as a living and holy sacrifice. Now, more on what that means in a minute. But right now, let's just focus on the sacrifice, or the presentation part, okay? We offer ourselves up to God. Not just part of us, we offer all of us. And this is what God wants, all of us. Paul says this is what's acceptable to God. Now, note that Paul doesn't mean here that in offering ourselves up to God, we make ourselves acceptable to God. He's just spent 11 chapters arguing that's not the case. It's the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross that makes us acceptable to God and our faith in that sacrifice. That's what changes our status from sinner to saint, from condemned to child of God. It's our faith in Jesus and what he's done. The point of the gospel is that only Jesus' sacrifice can make us acceptable in that sense. Here's what Paul means when he says this is acceptable to God, okay? He means that the presentation of ourselves to God, the putting of ourselves at God's disposal, is the response that God's looking for. That's the response that God wants to see in response to his mercy, to his demonstration of mercy and grace, to see us yield back to him our lives. And that's the only response that makes sense. Down at the end of verse 1, when Paul says this presentation is our spiritual service of worship, he does something really interesting there. He doesn't use the standard New Testament word for spirit or spiritual. That would be the word pneumatikos. Okay? Instead, he uses a word logikos. Okay? It's the same word we get our word logic from, right? And this is a word that comes from Greek philosophy. In Greek philosophy, this word referred to the rational principle that underlies the universe. You know, the invisible principle, that's why it's spiritual, the invisible principle that makes everything work, the reason, the structure behind the universe. If Paul wanted to say that our sacrifice was merely spiritual by nature, he would have used the word pneumatikos, but by using the word logikos, Paul is stressing that the only rational response that we can make to God's offer of salvation, the only thing that makes sense in view of this great gift God offers us, is to offer ourselves back to him. It's the only thing that makes sense. It's the only logical conclusion. Now, if that sounds like a tall order, then take heart, okay? You may say, Pastor, I've tried that. I've tried so hard to be good this year, and I just can't do it. Besides, the Bible tells me I just can't do it. Why should I offer myself up to God? Because the same grace that saves us also empowers us to surrender ourselves over to God. Hear me very clearly here, okay? Offering our full selves over to God is not just a matter of us trying harder. We have to make that clear because we Americans kind of have this bootstrap kind of mentality sometimes where we think all we got to do is grab our bootstraps and yank, and that's going to get us through it. That's not what Paul is talking about here. As the gospel teaches us, we can never try hard enough to overcome the pull of our sinful nature on our own. Remember that the Greek preposition I mentioned a while ago, it can mean by the mercies of God, it can mean by the means of, but it can also mean through. As we seek to offer ourselves to God in faith, his grace, the same grace that saves us, the same grace that calls us to salvation, that same grace can help us live in obedience and alignment with God's will. Paul says this a little differently in Galatians chapter 3, verse 20. He says, I have been crucified with Christ. In other words, he's identified with Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection by faith. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. So he says, by faith, Jesus is actually living his life through me. It's like Jesus superimposed his life on mine. He says, the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. See, this is not, well, I'm going to be a good person so that maybe God will have mercy on me and overlook some of my flaws, okay? This is, man, God has loved me so much. He has done so much to change my life. Then all I can do is reciprocate that love back to him. Jesus has done so much for me that the only reasonable thing I can do is offer myself back up to him. That's what Paul's talking about. To borrow from Jesus' own words in John chapter 15, we're like branches connected to a vine. Jesus is the vine. And as we abide in him, in other words, we trust in him, we walk daily with him by faith, we let him live his life through us, then we draw our life, our strength, our identity, everything that's significant in our lives comes through that relationship, that connection with Jesus. And as we are abiding in him, Jesus says, he who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. See, the highest form of worship is a life continually placed at God's disposal. Paul describes our proper response to God as an act of worship. He does this a couple of different ways. He calls this a spiritual service of worship. And the word worship there is latria. It's the standard word for rendering worship to God. And a lot of times, you know, we talk about worship, our brain automatically goes to some pretty specific things. We have images of people standing and singing, and we're singing songs. Maybe some people are raising their hands. We're praying. We're doing things like that. There's a whole lot more to real, genuine worship than that, okay? Paul also describes this response in terms of offering a sacrifice. Now, the original readers of Paul's letter to the church at Rome would have been well familiar with the concept of sacrifice. You had, if you're with us in our study of this book, you'll remember that the church at Rome was a multi-ethnic church. It started primarily as a Jewish group, people who'd grown up Jewish and then became followers of Jesus. And then as they practiced the gospel there in the city of Rome, it attracted Greeks, people who are Romans, people who had grown up pagan. And so they had come into the church as well. So they had these two different groups coming from different backgrounds, different perspectives, trying to follow Jesus together. But the Jewish disciples, they would have thought, when they hear the word sacrifice, they would have immediately had images of the Jewish priest in Jerusalem entering into the temple to offer the slain animal and its blood as a sacrifice for the atonement of sin. That's what they had grown up with. That was their understanding of sacrifice. You slay an animal, you put it on the altar, and allow it to be consumed. The Greeks, the Roman disciples who grew up pagan, they also would have been familiar with the concept of sacrifice. They would have been familiar with the concept of coming to the shrine of whatever particular Greek or Roman deity they were trying to appease and bringing some kind of gift to put on the altar there to hopefully buy some favor from that god. Hey, you know, Zeus, I do for you, you do for me, right? We good, right? That's how pagan religion works. You scratch my back, I scratch yours, right? Except you're dealing with supposedly divine beings when you say that. So both groups are familiar with this concept of offering something, putting it on the altar. But the worship that Paul is calling for here is of a different nature than what most people consider worship. In the first place, we don't present an innocent animal on our behalf. We present ourselves. He says, present your bodies. That's you. Okay? You don't bring an animal that you're going to cut its throat and put it on the altar and let it be consumed. You offer you to God. Secondly, our bodies represents all of us, our entire being. And that means, in part, presenting our bodies means that we seek to honor God through our bodies, our physical actions. It kind of goes against the notion I hear people express sometimes and think, well, you know, since our salvation is based on God's grace and not our good works, then it really doesn't matter what I, you know, live, how I live my life. I can do whatever I want to because God's still got all this. That's not exactly how this works. Yeah, we are saved by God's grace, not by our own works. But if we don't offer all of us, if we're trying to draw the dividing line between our souls and our bodies, we're missing the point. Because you're not, you know, a soul and a body over here. You are a soul, you have a body, okay? You can't really divide those, at least in the Jewish concept of this. Our bodies, the actions of our bodies reflect the actual status of our hearts. How you act in your body says something about what's going on the inside. Remember, Jesus says it's not what goes into the man that defiles the man. It's what comes out, because it's the things that come out reveal the status of your heart. So that obedience is important. To claim to offer ourselves to God spiritually while physically and habitually living contrary to his design is to treat Jesus' sacrifice with contempt. Is to cheapen what Jesus did for us. When we say, well, you know, it doesn't matter how I live my life because, you know, God's just concerned about my soul. It doesn't matter what my body does. We're actually treading on God's grace and treating it as cheap. We also don't present a dead sacrifice, but a living one. Did you catch that? He says, present yourselves as A living sacrifice. Now, that would blow their minds, okay? Because usually when you bring a sacrifice, you kill it. No, this is a sacrifice that goes on living and persisting. We're to put all of ourselves on the altar, and we live out that devotion, that consecration in our everyday lives. As we go about our lives, we are living our lives set apart for God. That's what it means to be a living sacrifice. We also, our sacrifice is not a one-time action, but is a continual process. I'm not going to bore you with the details here. Paul does use a particular Greek verb tense that could be used to describe a one-time action, but some of the typical markers that are usually present when that don't apply here. They're not present here. So basically what he's saying is you present yourself as a living sacrifice and you keep on presenting yourself as a living sacrifice. Here's the thing about living sacrifices, okay? They have a tendency to try to crawl off the altar. Don't we do that? You know, we get really excited, you know, maybe today, a new year, you're excited. This year I'm living for Jesus. And by Friday, this is like that resolution you made to lose weight. What do you do? I tried. No. Get back up on the altar. Get back up on the altar. Continually offer yourself to God as a living sacrifice. This is something we do as a matter of life. It's kind of like how, you know, following Jesus is described as a journey. We walk with him step by step. Now, sometimes we may step sideways. He calls us to get back behind him, to get on the path. It's not a one-time action. It's a continual process. Also, our worship is not a special activity conducted at a special time at a special place. But it's something that encompasses all of our lives. All of our life becomes an act of worship. This is your spiritual service of worship. This presenting ourselves, putting ourselves at God's disposal. The more that we grasp the significance of God's grace as we are doing this, the more our orientation will shift from the self-centered priorities of this world to the God-centered priorities of heaven. That brings us into verse 2. You see, in our daily lives, often the choice comes down between doing what's easy and doing what's right. Doing what's easy and doing what's right. You ever felt that pressure, that junction? Easiest thing in the world is to conform. Just go with the flow. You know, it's kind of like trying to stand upright in the middle of the waves. Easiest thing in the world is just to coast and let the current carry you. But that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. This is what Paul warns about when he warns against conforming to this world or this age. He's talking about our culture, the values and the priorities that are characteristic of a specific culture, a culture that tries to live as if God doesn't exist. And the values of this world that tries to pretend that God doesn't exist, are often in open hostility to the priorities of God. In James 4, verse 4, James warns, "Do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility towards God, is enmity towards God?" Conforming to this world means aligning with the priorities and the values that this world holds to be important. In 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, John warns us, "Do not love the world or the things in the world." Now, he's not talking there about Mother Earth, okay? He's not talking about the ground we walk on. He's, you know, we need to love our planet, our home. We need to take care of it. Because after all, we got to live in it, right? So he's not saying don't, you know, love the planet. He's saying don't love this world system, this culture that tries to live as if God doesn't exist, as if God is not relevant. He says, "Do not love the world nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Well, what does that mean? What are the things of the world? And so he tells us in verse 16, he says, "For all that is in the world," he names three things: the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. He says, those things are not from the Father, they're from the world. Now, we can spend a whole sermon talking about what that means, but in a nutshell, the lust of the flesh is fulfilling our physical desires in ungodly ways. It's taking the normal, natural desires God has given us and turning them in on themselves and allowing them to kind of become our gods. Okay, when we pursue sexuality that goes against what God has prescribed or prescribed rather in his word. When we, you know, well, here's one that's going to step on a lot of toes, especially this time of year. Gluttony. Okay. We make food a god. That doesn't mean you can't enjoy a fabulous meal every now and then. Okay, that's there's feasts all throughout the Bible to celebrate God's goodness and God's bounty. But when we make the pursuit of getting more and more food and that's just that feeling, that sensation, our God, our sense of identity, our sense of purpose, then we are worshiping the creation rather than the Creator. We don't really think about that one very much, do we? Gluttony. But whenever we allow a physical desire to become something that guides us and directs us, that's why pornography is so poisonous. Because we're allowing physical desires to be warped and corrupted in ungodly ways. That's the lust of the flesh. The lust of the eyes is probably even more insidious. That's things like greed, materialism, the thirst for power. When our pursuit becomes getting all we can and getting more and climbing that ladder, if that's where we get our identity and our security from, then we're at war with God. And then the one that underlies all of them, the sinful pride of life. That's enthroning ourselves in God's place in our hearts. Evicting God from his rightful throne and saying, God, we don't need you. We're going to pretend you don't exist and you're not a factor. And that's the one, if you go back to Genesis chapter 3, that's the one that underlies all the others. That's where it all starts. Now, Paul has actually already addressed this in the book of Romans. In Romans 1:21, he says, for even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. That's where everything went wrong. When we began to try to act and live as if God's not a factor, as if God doesn't exist, as if God's not on the throne, that's when we began to go off the rails. And in Galatians chapter 6, verses 19 to 21, Paul shows us what this looks like. He says, now the deeds of the flesh are evident. They are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, outburst of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, things like these. He says, these things which I forewarn you, just as I have forewarned you, that those who practice such things, in other words, those who are habitually engaged in such things, will not inherit the kingdom of God. Why? Because they've somehow racked up a negative balance? No. Because if you habitually are pursuing such things, if you're taking your security and your identity from such things, that's revealing something about your heart, that your heart is not really aligned with God, that you're not really walking by faith, that you haven't truly been redeemed. In contrast, those who are continually offering themselves as living sacrifices in response to God's grace, they're going to go through a process of transformation in which their values and their priorities are shifted from the values and priorities of this world to the values and priorities of God's kingdom. Okay, he says, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. What does that look like? Well, you know, think about Jesus in Matthew chapter 22, when he's asked, what is the greatest commandment? He says two things, basically. He says, love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. When your life is characterized by offering God, all of you, and making him the source of your identity and your security, and then through that you are loving other people with the same love that God has loved you with, then you're aligning with God's priorities and God's values. Going back to Galatians chapter 6, Paul says in verse 22, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. If the Spirit's present in your life, if you're walking in the Spirit, if you're abiding in Jesus like we talked about a few minutes ago, those are the kind of things that are going to be produced naturally in your life. Those fruits of the Spirit. He says, those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh and its passions and longings. Here's the thing. When we are yielding ourselves over to God and allowing him to transform our mind and shift our priorities, God receives glory when our minds align with his design. Paul closes out this paragraph and says, be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you may prove what the will of God is and that which is good and acceptable and perfect. When we reflect the values of God's kingdom in our daily lives, we're demonstrating that God's design is good and acceptable and perfect. Now, it is good and acceptable and perfect whether we align with it or not. But when we offer ourselves up to him and we allow him to work through us, people see his power at work in us, and they give him the glory. As Jesus said, Matthew 5:16, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and pat you on the back. No, that's not what Jesus said. They may see your good works and glorify your Father who's in heaven. See, when we live in alignment with God's design, God's the one that receives the glory. And so this year, may the way this year that we offer to God through our humble obedience influence others to worship God themselves. May they see him at work in us and be led to focus on him. Nearly all of us are familiar with Robert Frost's poem about the road not taken. Remember that one from high school English? You know, two roads diverged in a yellow wood. Sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one side as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. You remember, does that sound familiar? Remember that one? Okay, well, Jesus spoke about two roads as well. One road was broad, easy, well-traveled. It's a highway, but it leads to a dead end. If you take that road, you're going nowhere. The other road is narrow. It's twisting. It's steep. It's a climb. But if you take that road, which is the path of discipleship, here's the thing. You will never walk alone, because you'll always be walking with Jesus. Now, sometimes we may try to run ahead of him. Sometimes we may fall behind. Sometimes we may step off into the brush. But as long as we are keeping our focus on him and taking our identity and security from him, he's going to lead us in the right direction. He's going to lead us to life. So as we stand on the threshold of a brand new year, all the old things have passed away. We got a brand new sheet in front of us for this year with two paths lying before you. Which one are you going to choose?
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautics.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.